From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. There were fresh rallies held against U.S. police brutality across the country, with tensions continuing to simmer over the recent killing of two African-American men this past week, and scores more since the beginning of the year. Protesters were arrested in Baton Rouge, St. Paul, New York City, and elsewhere around the country. The protests in Baton Rouge were held outside police headquarters. Police say the detainees ignored repeated orders to stay out of the street. However, demonstrators say officers charged into the crowds without any provocation. Among those arrested in Baton Rouge was one presidential candidate, Gloria LaRiva, who is the standard bearer for the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
I was filming the police line. The police had completely blocked, with dozens of police, the highway road, a principal street. And there was no traffic on there, but as I was filming them, they grabbed me and arrested me. There were over 101 people arrested last night, and we just got out. Some of us just got out of jail a few minutes ago. There were more arrested today on Sunday in the afternoon at another mass and even larger protest. Young people coming from other cities and states. The struggle here for justice for Alton Sterling and many other people against all the police killings is growing. There is a national rage at what has taken place in Louisiana and Minnesota, where the young man, Philando Castile, was brutally murdered. People are very, very angry, and it's a united and multiracial movement. And the police are terrified of this. The FBI issued a statement yesterday trying to heighten the terror atmosphere. And I think they have given, with that statement, a green light to all the police forces that they can do whatever they wish in order to suppress peaceful protests.
In Memphis, protesters shut down the I-40 bridge for several hours. Similar actions were also held in several other cities, including New York and Atlanta. People in several European countries also staged demonstrations to express solidarity with the families of victims of recent U.S. police killings. This was the sound in London over the weekend as Black Lives Matter marches took place across the UK both Friday and Saturday. In Liverpool, where protesters gathered outside a major church to express their outrage over U.S. police violence, Black Lives Matter was the main slogan chanted. This was the sound in Germany's capital, Berlin, where Black Lives Matter protesters condemned deadly violence by police against the African-American community, demanding that officers involved in the killings be brought to justice. And this was the sound in the capital of the Netherlands, Amsterdam.
We are one! We are one! We are
Don't shoot!
That's not
as people took to the streets there in solidarity with the black community in the U.S. Thomas Muhammad is an activist and a veteran of the civil rights movement who lives in Dallas, Texas. He knew the alleged assailant in the Dallas attacks and had this to say.
I met him at several different community events where, you know, you have black empowerment and African-centered events. He wasn't any different than other young people that I've run across. Who were very frustrated with how things were for black folk in America, particularly the highlighting of the shootings of unarmed black folk by police. And so he was very angry about that. But again, he was with other youngsters and they were just as angry. And so he was very frustrated. And you know, their position is that we were doing so bad, we're being so oppressed, that they need to do something. Now, the way he chose, I knew nothing about, you know, it was going to happen. But when I saw his picture on the news, you know, circulated by the news, I was like, wow, you know, and it just blew me away that, you know, a brother who was looked so silent, you know, so cool and calm, you know, would come to this decision.
Last week's shootings in Louisiana and Minnesota are the subject of this commentary by imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Another one gone. And now comes another. Alton Sterling, father, husband, beloved of his family and friends, joins a tragic train of death. Mike Brown, Rekia Boyd, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, and on and on and on. All killed by cops just doing their jobs. At times like these, elections seem irrelevant, for they have no answer to this gnawing state of terror. No answer at all. Why should they? They were architects of it. They campaigned for these killers. They approved their militarization. The politicians running for office or running from office today were gung-ho for cops yesterday, sending them more and more of the people's tax dollars and more weapons of war. What did they expect? Now, within hours of Sterling's killing, another black man, Philando Castile, is gunned down in his car, sitting beside his lover, while reaching for his ID and registration demanded by a traffic cop. Another one gone, and another, and another. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Danny Haifong is an activist and a blogger with a regular column at blackagendareport.com. He's just finished the third edition of a series on President Barack Obama's legacy entitled simply Obama's Legacy. We spoke with him via Skype from Boston Sunday. Danny, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
So let's talk about the series you're doing on the Obama legacy. You're up on part three already on education legacy. Why don't you tell us first what the first three chapters are about, and let's talk about it.
So the 2016 elections have dominated the broad political narrative in the United States. We can't escape it. The Donald Trump phenomenon, the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, Hillary Clinton's vile record have all been a part of a renewed and re-energized political debate in the United States around just what do these elections represent? Just who do these candidates represent? And where should we channel our energies into these elections in order to build a real, genuine political movement on the left? And what I feel like has been missing is any sort of analysis about the last 7.5 years, coming on 8, of the Obama era. And so I found it to only be right to begin to analyze just exactly what led to this moment, this 2016 moment, where it seems like millions of people are discussing issues that were completely suppressed over the last 8 years, whether we're talking about the free trade agreements, which Obama has been trying to ram through, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, whether it's healthcare, where in the first part of my multi-part series about the Obama legacy, I talk all about the Affordable Care Act and how it basically handed over the entire political apparatus to the corporate monopoly insurance and pharmaceutical industry to basically distribute their products and mandate the public to purchase their overpriced and underinsured healthcare products, which has only continued to devastate working people in the United States. And in part two, I talk about the broad austerity agenda of the Obama administration, putting Social Security and Medicare on the chopping block for the first time in U.S. history since their inception, creating a commission that called for over $500 billion worth of cuts in Medicare and similar number of cuts of Social Security, as well as his draconian cuts to programs like food stamps, where we live in a period of complete low-wage subservience to corporate capital, where poverty increased every year of his administration, and where he basically facilitated through functions like quantitative easing straight to Wall Street's coffers a $4.5 trillion wealth transfer to the 1%. So this multi-part series, where in the next issue of BAR, public education will be discussed, and how, as Clinton destroyed welfare as we knew it in the 1990s, Barack Obama basically destroyed public education as we know it during his reign. And this multi-part series will go through some of the more pertinent topics and issues that affect the lives of working class people all over the world, in order to get a better understanding of just what this, what these last 8 years meant for oppressed and working people in the United States and around the world.
You know, it sounds like the first three chapters are really about austerity in healthcare, austerity generally, and austerity in education. It's austerity, austerity, and yet again more austerity, you know?
Yep. And that is the true Obama legacy, and that's why millions of people got behind Sanders, and why millions of people ultimately have gone behind Trump, because there is a divided working class in this country that, on the one hand, comprises of millions of young, mostly people of color, who have been totally fleeced by the last 8 years of Obama rule and the last 30 years generally. And then there's a section of white, historically unionized members of the working class, older, who have been fleeced by the last 8 years of Obama's rule. And healthcare was a huge part of this. Yeah. The Affordable Care Act mandates the purchase of health insurance that is publicly distributed but privately owned. Basically, what the Affordable Care Act did was, if you don't buy these insurance plans, you face a hefty fine come income tax day. But also, one has to look at what these plans actually cover. They're tiered based on the percentage of services covered, and they're also tiered based on the deductibles that one has to pay in order to receive coverage in the first place. Some of these deductibles range up to $4,000. And the cheapest plan only covers 60% of the services. And in healthcare, as I'm sure all of your listeners know, when you're only having 60% of your healthcare costs covered, you are in big trouble, because healthcare is the most expensive in the United States than anywhere else in the world. And that's why we have millions of people going without necessary treatment. And that's why we have millions of people continuing to die of treatments, of illnesses that have a relatively easy solution to them.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to think back to 2008 when the neoliberal Republican and Democratic mythology began to unravel in the form of the what they call the Great Recession, but the financial collapse and the economic doldrums that followed it. And, you know, it takes place within a historical context, of course, of deindustrialization of the United States and the growth of a permanent underclass, and the further impoverishment of that group by the reduction of benefits and things like under Clinton, where people end up working at Goodwill Industries or something for, you know, much less than the minimum wage in order to get the what used to be an entitlement payment from the state. You know, you have a manifestation of 8 years of frustration, essentially, among the working class behind both Trump and Sanders, as you mentioned. And you have a division by race, and you have some really interesting, I mean, you really have to deconstruct the political configuration, and that's not really done much here, even by people on the left, with the exception of over at Barr, of course, and the strong exception, and others, too, but particularly Barr. Republican Party, for example, the primaries, Trump as the winner of the primaries and the coalition assembled behind Trump's candidacy. You have, of course, the crazies that are, you know, connected to the Republican Party over white supremacy, essentially, that, you know, ideological or you know, something a little greedier and more base. And they are still there. Trump has, you know, made the comments he's made that about the border, about Mexico, about the Hispanics, you know, et cetera, and also about Islam and Muslims. And that kind of plays to that base the way almost all Republican candidates do that, and some Democrats, notably Bill Clinton did, for example, with Sister Solzha and all that. Mm-hmm. You also have, though, and I don't think they're given enough credit, members of the white working class and some other members of the working class, too, by the way, but largely white members of the working class. This is the Republican Party, which is where they went after the Southern Strategy was implemented, et cetera, that are there because of policy issues that Trump is identifying that are economic at their base. And the crudest way of summarizing it is, he's going to give me a job.
Yeah.
And of course, he's the perfect candidate for that with the TV career that he had, where he was the guy that hired and fired all the time. Okay. I mean, if you wanted a politician that was symbolic of hiring people and firing them, by the way, people should remember that, it's Donald Trump. Behind Sanders, you had essentially the same phenomenon. Only with and it even did, in fact, have a racial component, as we saw particularly in the southern states, but even in the north. Sanders didn't carry the same weight in terms of vote from the black community as he did from white community members. His, you know, in particular, it's not so profound among youth of all you know, ways, means, styles, etc. But you know, Clinton, for some reason, has the African-American vote throughout that whole process. And you have other sections of the working class where divided by race or more discreetly divided by race and age. That's what the condition is in the electorate right now. How do you, I mean, it seems like the task for working class is to find unity and a program of unity. How do you get there from here? I mean, well, and how does what Obama has done, I guess this is the germane part for your series, how does what's happened in the last 7.5 years, how did it bring us to this point, and how does it impede that unity?
Well, it's a critical question, because I think part of the reason why, or the reason why I decided to write this series on the Obama legacy is because I feel like it's one of the critical questions that's left out of this debate about who exactly are supporting the particular candidates in these elections, and how does it affect the working class movement in the United States. Barack Obama's legacy is not merely material. And what I mean by that is he did much damage to the working class. His policies were an intensification of Bush-era policies and an intensification of the last 30 years of dead-end neoliberal capitalism.
Yeah, and not for nothing, what Glenn Ford points out quite rightly, I mean, I think this goes to the heart of it, the largest transfer of wealth from one group to another, that being from the working class to the tiny elite in the history of humanity.
In the history of humanity, and that also includes the largest loss of wealth in Black America, right. which is not usually talked about. I think right. Black America right now has less wealth and less economic stability than it did in the civil rights era. And that's usually a silent point when it comes to political discourse in the United States. But in terms of the material consequences, they directly relate to the political consequences of the Obama administration. So Black Agenda Report has called Barack Obama ever since his first day that he announced that he would be running for president in 2008, the more effective evil, whereby he has been able to get away with a lot of these draconian austerity on steroid policies because of his impact in the political realm. So Barack Obama was able to effectively neutralize the Black left in a lot of ways. There had been an authoritarian right-wing process occurring in this country far before the Obama administration came into office, but it seemed like his administration was the climax to that authoritarian process, where now we see millions of Black voters continue to support Hillary Clinton, who is an extension of Barack Obama,
and
who has received support from Barack Obama. And that's a big reason why a lot of Black voters continue to support Hillary Clinton, especially as Black Agenda Report has rightly pointed out, the Republican Party has acted for decades now as the quintessential so-called white man's party or white supremacist party. The Republican Party has represented the boogeyman, and the Democratic Party has represented the savior over these last few decades. And that has turned politics upside down for the working class. And so now we see in 2016, a lot of these contradictions begin to sharpen to the point where there are people in motion. And these people in motion represent the demographics that have been manufactured and put into an electoral bubble. We see the white working class that has historically supported the GOP based on the conservatism and the racism. One should read Gerald Horn's book about the counter-revolution of 1776 to understand why white working class Americans would support right-wing politicians who speak to maybe some economic issues, is that there's a long history behind that. And we also see white working class people support Sanders, and also a lot of Black working class young people. We see that the last 30 years, and especially the last 8 years of Obama's rule, continue to create a mass of folks into the service sector, into the $1 trillion student debt bubble, into a lot of these critical issues that afflict working people in the United States. It's coming to a critical mass, and we're seeing the first signs of people taking sides around that. So the Obama era has truly been all about confusing the political landscape in the United States to allow the ruling class to continue its project of endless austerity, endless privatization, endless super exploitation of workers in order to feed its crisis-ridden system. That has been the agenda all along, and the Obama era was the true Trojan horse that allowed this this project to be packaged as a lesser of two evils.
You know, so that leaves us where we are now. And that includes, for example, Obama campaigning with Hillary Clinton, and you know, the basically making the social issues primary issues. Not even in terms of policy, they don't actually. Obama did, you know, presided over, for example, the largest loss of wealth in the Black community in the history of the United States, vis-a-vis the normative. You know, their position actually fell at a steeper rate than at any time before, perhaps since the after the Reconstruction period. And Hillary Clinton, of course, has a record of her own on you know, in terms of gender rights issues, in terms of gender equality, you have, you know, the DOMA that her husband signed into law and that she helped to promote. And you also have, of course, dead women and women living in feudal conditions in a number of places in the Middle East as a direct consequence of the work that she did and that her husband did. And yet they're campaigning and resonating among sectors of the electorate, you know, as signifying, you know, black civil rights and human rights and the rights of women, the champions.
Yeah. And that's maybe the issue that needs to be taken up when it comes to the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party, until it fractures to the point of its dissolution, will always try to frame itself as the progressive alternative to the white supremacist party. Part of that is being able to latch onto issues that can appeal to the capitalists and the 1% that it serves, but also can also have a relative appeal to the voting base that the Democratic Party so desperately seeks out, the black vote, the women vote, and the LGBTQ lobby in the you know, human rights realm. So really, in order to get this conversation back to the issue of class, an examination of the Democratic Party's record over the last few decades needs to happen. And I think the Obama administration's rule has been the most sharp in terms of this trend of the Democratic Party becoming the truest expression of the ruling class of the United States, but of the world capitalist and imperialist system that is wreaking havoc all over the world. You know, a lot of people still think that Hillary Clinton, especially given this email initiative, this email scandal, was the architect. A lot of people are very angry about Hillary Clinton. I feel like Hillary Clinton has gotten so much more criticism in the 2016 elections than Obama has ever received in the last 8 years, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton is basically Barack Obama slightly juiced. She takes a more rightward position on a lot of these issues, but Barack Obama basically made that possible, not only taking her under his wing at the State Department in order to wage endless war all over the world, but also he basically emulated a lot of the economic and intensified a lot of the economic policies that Hillary Clinton and her husband were parading around and pushing down the throats of working people. I mean, look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's been called NAFTA on steroids by many analysts and political commentators. And that's because it is. It would basically give the power of multinational corporations to sue sovereign governments that get in the way of their profits, and that is basically handing over sovereign countries to the rule of capital in the most direct and sharpest form. So this is the issue. We need to get back into class politics, and that's what I'm trying to do when I go over the Obama legacy, because the issues that most affect working people are basically the issues that the Obama administration have stood on the opposite end of for the last 8 years.
Danny Haifong, thank you very much, and we'll be talking with you more about that series as it unfolds.
Thanks, Don. Look forward to it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.